Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Professor Aliyah Saperstein. She's a professor of sociology at Stanford University who studies the perceptions of race and gender. She's also been a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. Professor Saperstein, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your research taps into some broad questions about race and ethnicity and how those constructs may be changing in American society. And I want to get to those broader questions, but I wanted to start first with a more narrower focus on your research itself. So if you could just start by telling me, what have you been doing to investigate how people perceive the race of other people? What kind of studies have you undertaken to get at that?
So the interesting wrinkle in my research that's different from the way other people have approached it in the past is that I'm not only interested in how people self-identify or how other people classify them, but I'm interested in how that changes over time. So that means I need to use data where we have multiple measures of how someone sees someone else. And in particular, I draw a lot on a survey called the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth. And in that survey, the survey interviewers, so the person who came to your house to ask you all the questions about the survey, at the very end of the survey was asked to record your race. And they were given three categories, white, black, and other. They were given no instructions on what those categories meant or how they were supposed to apply them to the person they were interviewing. But so for the people in the survey, because they were interviewed year after year after year, for some of these people, we have as many as 17 racial classifications that were made by the interviewer. And some of those change over time, and we can look at those patterns and see what predicts changes in particular directions.
So tell me a little bit more then about the people whose perceived race change. So give me some – how does that work? So all along someone is recorded as being black and then in year six they become white or vice versa?
That's one example. There are actually a number of different ways. So about a little bit more than 20% of the people in the survey change at least once. So like the example you just gave, they're white in all the years and black in just one, or they're black in all the years and they're white in just one. But other people may have different patterns where for 4 years they're white and for the rest of the years they're other. Or they may kind of bounce around from black to white to other repeatedly over time. So we can kind of study these in a given year. We can ask, well, who switched from white to black and what else was going on in their life? But we can also think about, well, what causes a shift versus what causes someone to just kind of, we're not really sure what they are at any point in time.
Well, that was the one thing I wanted to ask you about and then get into this pattern that you might have found. But first, you said 20%, right? So roughly 20%. So one thought that would come to mind immediately is, well, are these just the 20% of folks that have a skin tone or a set of features that kind of, you know, they're mixed race, they're mixed ethnicity, and so one interviewer might, in a forced three-part category, put them in white versus black? Is that what's driving it, or what makes you think it's something other than that, for lack of a better word, kind of coincidence?
So I think there's a number of things that's driving it, and what you just described is certainly one of those things. We might think of that as ambiguity.
Okay.
So, you know, they were given white, black, and other. That's a pretty basic scheme. There are many other categories that we recognize, certainly that we let people self-identify now. Hispanic, Asian, American Indian, Pacific Islander, where do you put those people? So we might imagine that the people that are bouncing around a lot are the people who don't have a category that fits them. But there are other examples of patterns of fluidity where, like I said, they shift dramatically from one to another category.
And then it stays permanent for that,
exactly,
for that period of time.
Exactly. Okay. And so that makes me think that this isn't solely about ambiguity, that certainly, not to get too scientific-y, but you might imagine you need some ambiguity to experience a change. There has to be ambiguity for that to happen. But when racial fluidity happens, we don't have to assume that the reason it happened was only ambiguity. And so we can ask, for example, not just did they change, but, okay, maybe it's someone who identifies as Hispanic, but why did they change from white to black in that particular year? Given that they could be seen as one or the other, is there a reason they're seen as something at a particular time?
And what are some of those reasons that you think you've found? What are the things that would make someone change from evaluating them or identifying them as white and then now identifying them as black?
Well, unfortunately, one of the things that we're seeing is that when things change in their lives in terms of status, so do they lose a job? Do they get married? Do they move to the suburbs? Do they become an unmarried parent? So either by having a child out of wedlock or by getting divorced. You know, some of these things we think of as positive things, and some of these things we think of as negative things. And many of them we associate with some groups more than others. And what we find is that in the years when things happen, like becoming an unmarried parent that we have stereotypes about and might associate more with black people than white people, that those people are more likely to change from white to black in a year that they experience that change in social status in the stereotypical direction.
And is it possible, is there a stickiness to this that it's more likely to go from white to black, or do you also see going from black to white or other to white?
It's really interesting. The changes go in all directions.
Okay.
So there's no direction that never happens. Certainly some directions are more common than others. So more of the changes are between white and other and between other and white. And once people are classified as black, they do tend to stay black in the survey. So just to give you a sense of the order of magnitude, on average across the survey, 9% of the time, if you were classified as not white in a given year, you could be classified as white in the next year. So that's on average about how many changes we see in that particular direction. On average, we see changes from not black to black about 0.7% of the time. So it's happening a lot less. But when it happens, it still happens in that complementary pattern, not complementary in the good way, but complementary in the sense that when something negative happens in your life, you're more likely to be seen as black afterwards. Mm-hmm. And when something positive happens in your life, you're more likely to be seen as white afterwards.
Now, you've also looked at how people's perceptions of their own race change, right? So tell me about that work.
That's a little bit trickier, and mostly because we don't tend to ask people again how they self-identify unless we've changed the measure. So when we change the question, either the wording of the question or we want to give people more categories, then we tend to ask them again. And so it can be very difficult if you change the measure to figure out, well, is this real change or is this just change because we changed the measure? So a lot of my work does focus on interviewer classification because that measure doesn't change over time. So we can't attribute the changes in race that we see to the changes in the question. So we don't have a lot of data on self-identification where we can really see it cleanly. But the data that we do have follows a similar pattern so that people who are incarcerated, people who lose their jobs, people who whose incomes fall below the poverty line in between when we first ask their race and when we next ask their race change their category in the stereotypical direction.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Aliyah Saperstein, a sociology professor at Stanford University. So have you also done work on perceptions of gender that takes a similar vein or relates to this in some ways?
Similar. I think it's been really interesting. I've started out studying race, but there's been so much more conversation now about how we conceptualize sex and gender and whether we think these are things that change over time, whether they should change over time. And it was really striking to me. I first started, I was interested in how surveys had measured race. So I was looking over the last 60 years at a bunch of different surveys and trying to track the trends and how they asked about race. What were the questions? What were the categories? That sort of thing. And the race question on a survey is usually right before or right after the sex question on the survey. And so in trying to track the trends in race, I couldn't help but notice that the race question changes dramatically over time. Wording, categories, the whole thing. Sex question, always exactly the same. Always male and female, no other options, never worded any other way. And in most surveys, still classified by the interviewer. You know, it's not something that most surveys even ask people to self-identify. It's like we see it as so obvious, we don't even need to ask. So I was really struck by that distinction, and that kind of headed me down the path of, well, why is it, you know, theoretically we think that both of these things could change, and yet when we measure them, we never let sex and gender change. So that kind of what started me down that path.
Now, some of this, particularly what you were saying before about race and perceptions of race, seems reminiscent to me of earlier periods in a way. I mean, this idea that, for example, groups that immigrated from Europe, different groups were often perceived as non-white for a long time, and then they become white, you know, the Irish, Eastern Europeans, others. And even today, and I find this phrase repugnant, so I'm going to use it with that caveat, but the phrase white trash seems to evoke something of what you're looking at. Could you comment a little bit on how this fits in with other things that we might already be more familiar with?
That is a great question. I think the phrase white trash has a lot. It's so loaded. But it says a lot about what we think about whiteness, that we need to modify it by saying white trash implies that whiteness is not normally trashy. And so in many ways, it's similar to the way that we think about the black category. The black category needs to be modified when we say the black middle class. We need to modify it to signal to people, oh, we're not talking about blacks in general. We're talking about the black middle class. Similarly, white trash functions in a sense. Oh, we're not talking about whites in general. We're talking about white trash. And so I think it's symbolic of the way that we think about the category itself.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Stanford University sociology professor Aaliyah Saperstein. Her research is focused on perceptions of race and gender. Well, it sounds to me like a lot of what we've been talking about is tapping into the intersections of race and ethnicity with class. That there's, and you were just talking about this before the break, that there's this class stratification that we associate with race, and we use race to label. And I think Americans often have a hard time really talking about class. Do you think that we might be using race labels as proxies for class in some way?
I think that's definitely the case. I think it's maybe even a little bit more complicated than just class. One of the reasons that we say that we measure race, for example, in the census, is to monitor discrimination. Mm. That's the reason why the federal government asks you this question, because they need it to enforce the Voting Rights Act, because they need it to provide data for the EEOC for employment claims. That's about a little more than just class. We might think that people who are poor and marginalized are more likely to be discriminated against, but we have a lot of reason to believe that people are discriminated against on reasons that are not just class. And so that makes it really challenging, because if we're trying to measure race because we want to measure discrimination, and those things, race, class, discrimination, are all entwined, then our measures aren't necessarily doing exactly what we want them to do. And I think that's what frustrates people about, why are you asking me this question? What are you going to do with this data? We have a thorny problem that we haven't unpacked yet. And I think people are confused and frustrated with that situation.
And I guess to really get at that, you'd have to take an entire life history to see how those things intersect, and that's not going to work for the purposes that these surveys are designed to
exactly
help with.
Exactly. The federal government, I mean, we would never tell them, oh, yes, please take all of my tax dollars so that we can have regular, you know, decadal life history collections of everyone in the country. So we're really, you know, they're really using race as a proxy for this other thing that we think goes along with race. And when it frustrates people is when that's not true. So, you know, when white people feel like, well, I've been discriminated against and that isn't being recognized, it's because we associate the category white with the lack of discrimination.
Now, this election season that we've gone through has caused a lot of people to worry whether we're taking some kind of significant long-term step backward on inclusion and tolerance when it comes to ethnicity and race. Do you think, looking back over the past year, that's what's happened?
I hope not. I'm certainly shocked and appalled too often these days when I look at the news or look at my Twitter feed. But I am hopeful that this is one of those moments where things have to get worse before they get better. Mm. That part of what we're seeing is people are speaking out and people are recognizing that there's a problem, and there's not agreement on how to solve it, but at least we're paying attention to the fact that there's a problem, and that the fact that there's a problem and the fact that people are speaking out against it, sometimes very vocally, sometimes in places where we don't expect, like kneeling in the middle of a football game, or not in the middle, but during the national anthem, right, for example, right. That those moments cause tension and conflict. But if we don't expose them, then they're just lurking beneath the surface waiting to cause problems later.
And this may be just the same question, but in a different version. But how would you perceive America's arc on this issue at present? I mean, how is the arc bending? Do you still feel like it's bending toward justice, as King said several decades ago?
Wow, that is an excellent question. I imagine it depends on what day you ask me that question. So precisely today, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we are bending towards justice. I am a demographer, so I believe in what's called cohort replacement, that as people age, we replace them with younger people who have different ideas. And for the most part, I think our younger people have ideas that are bending in a good direction in terms of that arc.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Stanford University sociologist Aliyah Saperstein. So do you think that you often hear this idea of a race-blind society? Maybe we don't hear it quite as frequently as we did 10, 15 years ago, but you still hear it. Is that something it's possible, or is it even desirable?
I think right now it's not desirable. Perhaps for some of the same reasons that we were just talking about, we need to face these problems. And so being blind to them, because race is a big part of where these problems came from, I think being blind to them is not helpful. But it is helpful, I think, to think about what is the society that we want to become. And I think for many people, thinking of a race-blind society is a hopeful end point. That we wouldn't have these tensions, that they wouldn't matter. But I think what that misses is that for many people, because race is associated with identity, because race is associated with culture and place of origin, that's asking some people to give up something that means a lot to them. Mm-hmm. And we can think about that sometimes these identities were created because they were ways of coping with the problems. And so, or they weren't created, but they gained power that way. The idea that black is beautiful, right? We're going to reclaim something that has been negative. And so that's a source of positive identity. And I think we need to recognize that those are important too. So I think it's less, what we should focus on less is whether or not people claim certain identities and that those identities make them, quote unquote, different than other people. We need to make sure that regardless of the identity that people claim, that their well-being is not different than other people, that there aren't systematic differences in well-being based on the thing that is important to you in terms of your identity.
And how important do you think it is that the United States will, in the foreseeable future, no longer be a majority white country?
I was just talking about this with some undergraduates, and I think I might have blown their mind. So we'll see what happens
right.
with your listeners.
Let it fly.
So that statement that we will be becoming a minority-majority society is dependent on the way that the census projects racial populations in this country. And the formula that they use to project racial populations in this country makes a number of assumptions about things like fertility and mortality and migration, but also about how race is transmitted across generations. So the projections assume, for example, that a child will follow the race of its mother. Now, this is a convenient assumption for demographers because if you look at birth certificates, there's always a mother's race and there's always a child. There's not necessarily always a father listed on the birth certificate. So this is purely a convenience for calculation. We have data on the mother and the child. So we're going to use those to connect. Okay, well, the child is whatever the mother was. But if we have increasing interracial marriage, that assumption may not be true. And we're then making assumptions about how the child is going to identify when they grow up as an adult. So I think we could – it's probably better to think about the racial origins that people might have. And so people might have more diverse origins moving forward and that those people might become a majority of our society. But I think it's not quite accurate to say that we know that white people will be in the minority at a certain date because we don't know how those children are going to identify.
I see. We only have a couple minutes left, but there's a more personal question that I wanted to put to you, if I may. Did you learn any lessons about race and ethnicity when you were growing up that you think now are informing the academic work that you do or that you're working through or that you're pondering as you do this research?
I don't know if I would call it a lesson necessarily, but I do think that what I experienced growing up probably inspired me or encouraged me in these directions, even if it was – I didn't think of it at the time. But I grew up in Seattle, and I attended a high school that was racially diverse on paper, but it was very – what academics call tracked. Mm-hmm. So the advanced placement classes were white. The quote-unquote regular classes were non-white, and in the case of my high school, predominantly black. But it wasn't just that. The actual physical space in the building was also – so the AP classes were all on a particular floor, and the other classes were all on a particular floor. So it created this – structure that I think a lot of people took for granted. They just thought it was normal. And for whatever reason, it never seemed normal to me. And so I think asking questions about why that is and why it is that we think certain people should do certain things or should be in particular places, I think those kinds of questions have always motivated my work.
That was Aaliyah Saperstein. Aaliyah, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.